a three-phased approach to AI implementation. Mm-hmm. What I noticed is everyone asked the same question. How much are we spending on those tokens? And there was this finding where perhaps people from the African continent or certain East Asian nations, that data is never shared with the models.
Get familiar with Claude.
Yes.
Learn to tell a story with dashboarding and be a spanner. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of GCC Tech Talks by 70 Experts. We've got another summer edition. We're getting into the heat of
hat?
Dubai.
Where's your hat?
Yeah, if you go on GCC Tech Talks LinkedIn page, you will notice us in Trilby hats looking quite festive. I did try and find a floral polo to wear today, but it was a golf one. It didn't quite look right. But yeah, you feeling summery today?
I am, yes. It is very warm outside. I think the temperature started to tip over 45 now. It's getting to the point unbearable, I think, is the right way of putting it. I spend 5 minutes waiting for my son and I'm, you know, soaking wet.
I think the hardest part is just trying to get in the car when it's been sat in the sun for so long. The steering wheel's too hot. The gear sticks too hot.
Yeah. But and the air conditioning doesn't kick in.
Yeah, the air conditioning takes a while. But on today's episode, we got one very close to our hearts, being in the data analytics space, because we have Saima Ali who's joined us today.
Hello.
And we'll get into a little bit about yourself and what it is you do. But you're a director of data and AI and analytics, kind of how you describe yourself.
Yes, that's correct. I'll give you my elevator pitch. Who am I? I'm someone who hates to stay in one industry. So I've worked 17 years in the field and I've never been in the same industry twice. Started off in healthcare, went to financial services, then moved to Dubai, went to aviation for 6 years. And then I was at the tech hub of Careem for a very long time. And now I'm in media and streaming in the world of TV.
So you've sort of seen it all.
I've
seen all sorts of data in your time. Well, we'll probably get into that a little bit. I'd love to kind of start with you know, growing up. Where did you grow up? Kind of how did you get into data? And, you know, maybe we'll go more into career stuff in a bit.
So I grew up in Toronto. And why the sigh? I am one of six kids. And I think that plays a part too.
I am too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I am too.
Did it 12 siblings between the two. That's a lot.
And a lot of in-laws as well. And then the children.
And a lot of cousins.
Yeah. Yes, because we're brown, right? Yeah. But did it make you want to be more organized in life? Because...
Yes, definitely so. Yes, yes. I remember summers, 25, 30 of us. And sometimes in a room that was probably as big as this room, chaos.
That's crazy. And my things would always get lost, like toys are getting lost and things are getting misplaced in your clothes. And I think that's probably what spurned my love of just logic and keeping track of everything and being very organized. And then I ended up by fluke at university in a program that was focused on data management. And I was lucky enough to be in the program that offered a co-op or internship placement while you're in university. And I did my first internship at the Toronto Airport, actually. And I got to see, you know, data engineering and business intelligence, which is decision support way back then. And I was like, yeah, I think I could do this. I think it's fun. And that spurred the journey.
Love that. So going into kind of data at university, what aspect of data kind of grabbed you? Because you said there, you know, there's data engineering, there's machine learning, there's predictive analytics, there's, you know, your traditional management information or BI, as we call it today, which is now changing. But was there any sort of aspect that you kind of gravitated towards?
I think it was not the technical stuff for sure. So I was very interested in storytelling. I think it was very easy to look at the output of what I was working with. I actually did really poorly in SQL, which is surprising if you think about where I am now.
We'll cut that one out. No one knows.
But I love the fact that you can transform raw data into an insight that no one knows before, but then tell it in a fun way. I love telling stories. I would make PowerPoints for fun. Back when people were writing things by hand, I was creating PowerPoints and sending them in, or creating websites to tell my story. And that, I think, is probably a very important aspect of being a leader in the space. Because when you're talking to business people, they don't care about what we care about. They don't care about the stats or the math. They don't care about how much data we pulled. They're like, how does this impact my business? And that's where I spent a lot of my time, even at university.
I think that's such an underappreciated aspect of the role, especially as a data leader.
Yeah.
The world today, there's so much technology, and explaining that to business leaders to try and drive, okay, business outcomes, KPIs, it's very easy to fall into a technical conversation being from a data background. It's very hard to translate what you're doing from a data function into something that's, you know, an executive who's got the attention span of a, you know, a gnat is going to be able to understand and put forward to his business. There's a guy, Andy Cockreave, when I was at Tableau, he was our technical evangelist. Mm-hmm. He was an unbelievable data storyteller. So he created the big book of dashboards, it was at the time. And one of the stories that he told was, okay, how do you take like news, turn it into a dashboard, but just changing the colors of a chart, how that changes your perception and your narrative from something negative to positive.
Yeah.
And you know, what's the story you're trying to tell from that dashboard can really influence the way that even it looks and the way that people interact with it.
Yeah, it sounds like to me that you're one of those people where you take a very dull dashboard and the changes that you'll make will make someone use it. So that's the way I see it. Because if we go back maybe 10, 15 years, we used to build a whole bunch of dashboards, you know, like business dashboards for each department or each vertical in a bigger corporation, should we say. And if you looked at the stats sometimes of the usage, it used to be, you know, some of them used to be sky high. That's because the person on the business side has either done the requirements gathering, like, you know, as in, like, he's put forward what he exactly wants to see. And he might have even designed the dashboard. Then you have other departments where they're not that data literate, shall we say. But they need something. They need some reporting function. And they've kind of been led by the technical team. But that technical team has got to a stage where it's copied another dashboard in order to present the data, but there's no story behind it. Nothing flies off the page into your eyes. And I think Saima is the perfect candidate, shall we say, to take, say, 10 dull-looking dashboards that have very little usage and turn them into dashboards that appeal to people. And the usage starts to kind of come up. I've come across quite a few individuals like that. I think they're few and far between, and they tend to usually not like SQL.
Well, I like it now. Don't get me wrong. But you know, it's very interesting you say that. And I think my first exposure to creating beautiful dashboards was when I came here and I worked at the government. Now, government in Dubai, coming from the like Toronto, it's a very different kind of place to be, and I really, really respect this boss of mine. He said to me, make me a slide that looks pretty, because if it's not pretty, I won't be able to keep attention in the room. And that's when I realized, I was like, he said, just put a pie chart on the page. And I interpreted that to mean beauty. And then an old mentor of mine from Kareem, he said, treat your dashboards, even as a leader, as your morning newspaper. And I don't like opening a dashboard. That doesn't make sense to me. Because that's the worst way to start your morning. What are we working towards? What does the business care about? Am I deviating? Am I drifting? Or am I on track? Is probably the first thing I need at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of junior people don't realize what the business needs are. And it's our job as leaders to guide them and say, bring it back. Bring it back. Give them a high level view first. Bring it to 30,000 feet and then drill down where they actually care.
What do you think the biggest challenges are, or the ones that you've come across, when it comes to adaptation? From your experience, what are the biggest challenges, and how have you gone about kind of dealing with those challenges?
You're so right. When you see your team put hours and weeks sometimes into a dashboard that no one uses, it's very crippling to your junior team as well, right? They feel a lack of motivation, that their work doesn't matter. So you start to pick up on trends on what is it that you as a business lead or business owner care about on a daily basis versus a one-off request. A one-off request does not need a dashboard, and that's what I always tell my business stakeholders or partners. Do you really need this as a dashboard, or can I pull an analysis for you, which will answer the question? If they really insist on a dashboard, I always say this is going to be a two-step process. It's going to be one that's a rough and tough kind of draft view that gives you the important stuff. If you're using it while we're iterating, I'll give you something more. Usually they don't need the details as much, right? And you have to use this matrix to understand what is this data driving, what decision is being made. And the details usually are not needed on a daily basis. You need to see that once in a while.
Teams often get drowned in the cyclical change request. Yep. And it's very easy to get buried by that when you're just saying yes to requirements. Mm-hmm. Let's go find the data. Let's go to build a dashboard, stick it out. As to you say, you know, get three views a month. Yeah. You think I've just spent ages when I could have been working on something else. The market is kind of now at that changing point where organizations, especially leaders, going, oh, let's slap Claude on top of our data. Let me access it, which in theory sounds like a great idea, but you know, for our audience, you know, I assume that's probably a requirement that's coming up for you and you know, talking about it with your community of data people here in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, so we've seen this in one of the places that I work. We actually started integrating agents into Slack. So there's multiple things that happen. Most often what happens is someone from product going, tagging the analyst and going, is this correct?
Okay.
So I think we need to be very careful about AI in general. One of my fears is always an over-reliance on the numbers. So what I like to say, always preface with, this is going to be directional only. Please do not use any of the data that's produced by an AI model or AI agent to give you hard facts that could be presented to the board or used for forecasting. That's just very dangerous. Use it as a directional piece of information to help you just get past your current block. And then let's see how we can keep the human in the loop to make sure we have things like certified data sets. Is this matching what we expect? Then build in anomaly detection on top, right? So we can use automation of, is this drifting 2, 3, 4 standard deviations away from what I expect? Yeah, it's very technical, but this is how we can catch things, because an agentic AI can drift very quickly when it's unchecked. And that's my biggest fear. And it's actually very costly as well. What I noticed is everyone asks the same question. How much are we spending on those tokens? I'm going to take this another way, right? I fear that we're over relying on AI at a speed which is potentially detrimental to the cost of the company.
Yes. Have you heard the phrase token maxing? Because I saw that online. Have you heard this?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
And I've got friends who I used to work at Tableau and now other companies, and he's posting, this one particular guy, he's posting on LinkedIn that he's the highest solution engineer in the team with tokens. And you think, you know, I came out, I can't remember which organization it was, they burnt through their yearly AI budget in a month.
Microsoft.
I think, no, it wasn't, was it Microsoft? It might have been Microsoft.
No. I don't think it was Microsoft.
It was another big organization. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember for the life of me who it was.
I think, you know, the question that is starting to play on people's minds now is, how much is this going to cost me? It's not, oh, can AI do this? But how much is going to cost me to get to this stage? Mm-hmm. And the questions I always ask is, how much automation do you want to do with this requirement that you're thinking? Because if the requirement starts off is, say, I'm just giving a random example. I want to automate my invoice process. What does that exactly entail? And how much of it do you want to really automate? And like, it's like the cost of automation versus what the existing cost is at the moment. There has to be the right balance, should we say. And I think even if we look at self-service analytics, what we're seeing now is a new era where what we're doing is we're putting all of our models, our existing models that we used to use for BI, you know, for traditional reporting, and we're saying, right, we're going to slap Claude on top of it, right? Okay. What's the cost behind it? What's the cost of me asking 10 questions a day? What's the cost behind 100 people asking 10 questions a day? Mm-hmm. And I think those are the type of questions that are starting to come up now. And that's why I feel as though there's so much concentration on getting the cost of the tokens down. Because even Databricks, you know, like most recently, there was a study around tokens being used in Claude, outright Claude, mm-hmm. and the tokens being used via Databricks for Claude as well. And there's a difference. Mm. There is a difference. And I think the cost element is starting to come in. That's what I'm trying to say. The cost element, and I don't think the cost element was there in the last couple of years. Everyone was like, can I try and do this before everyone else?
Exactly. Especially in this region.
Yes, yes.
Especially if you work in tech in this region, you have to be the first.
Yes.
Also, I think it's important to understand in which context or setting do we need an AI solution?
Yep.
Before agentic AI, we still had automation that helped leaders get the answers. So you can do automated reporting that comes into Slack to your cell phone via text message or anything that gives everyone the information they need without them having to go and ask for it 10 times. Dashboards are still useful for organizations that are maybe T-1. The other day I was in a call and someone said, for ministries of defense, maybe that's no longer possible in today's day and age with the political climate. I get it. That's a justified use of tokens in a, you know, I get it. But if you're reporting on T-1 day or T-30 days, why do you need to use all those tokens? Just go and use the dashboards we've created and the emails that you're getting and the analyses that have been presented. For the sake of making life easier, we're spending a lot of money and we're impacting the climate in ways that we won't be able to recover from.
Yeah, a lot of the vendors out there now, you've probably seen the phrase dashboards are dead. They're not dead because like you say, you know, if you've got the same BAU data and KPIs that just been pushed to the business, you don't 15 people asking questions in a chat bot instead of just going on a report that comes into your mobile phone or your inbox, right? So there's a world where they're complementary, you know, and organizations are kind of looking at it as the AI side is, you know, can we, for small self-serve type use cases for unstructured, semi-structured data, and then, you know, we're still going to save costs by using dashboarding as a route to insight.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I wanted to kind of touch upon and get your comments on and your opinion is full automation. Like, as in, where do you feel we are in the region, especially in this region, at giving the permission to agents to go and do what they want?
I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
My philosophy, and I don't know if others agree with it, I try to take a three-phased approach to AI implementation, right? So the first will be, can I make my life and my team's life easier? That should be step one. Step two should be automation of basic tasks. So you use, you know, Copilot to help you with your code, your code reviews. Number, like your third level should be this full solution. But that has to go through rigorous training and testing. The human in the loop element at that point becomes so important because, like I said, drift can come in so quickly. So full automation, if it impacts your revenue, I feel like it's very dangerous if you don't have human in the loop.
Why do you think it's dangerous, just for our audience? What makes it dangerous?
It's a reversibility versus cost equation for me. So can I reverse what potentially could have gone wrong? If I can, how detrimental was it to my business? So the cost can also be two ways. It's a hard financial or financial number, or it can be trust lost. And sometimes trust loss can be worse than the financial losses. So was it worth it for me to go full automation without really trialing everything just to be the first? I do believe that the models are getting, they're getting so good. It's actually very difficult to keep up with what's happening right now. We're seeing emergency seminars, you know, in the evenings to say, here's how you can use Fable or whatever. But I think we're still very early to say, here, just take over invoicing altogether and start billing my customers.
Yeah. With, I think everyone's heard some horror stories of where they've tried to, you know, fully automate that type of process.
Yeah, I think reputation, like you touch upon, reputation, I think, is it takes years to build. And you could erode it in seconds with an AI tool that goes rogue. I think everyone's starting to have that conversation now, though. It's more and more. I've seen it more and more. It's not about what can we do with AI. It's how do we control AI? I think the guardrails and also as well the governance. I think the governance. I wouldn't say it's fully there yet. It's nowhere near what it is with like data governance. Data governance is, I think, very, very advanced. It's been around for a long time. I think AI governance is still in a stage where we're still poking and prodding and trying to get the answers to what we actually put in. The guardrails we actually start to put in. I think everyone started to put certain guardrails in, like costs we talked about. Mm-hmm. But I think around the data, it's a lot more complex, I believe.
Well, you see it a lot now from a governance standpoint, and you're probably working on this type of thing, is you can't just let AI models go to the data because it doesn't have the context, doesn't have the ontology, all of that baked in. So then there's, you know, data teams are now scrambling to go and make sure that there is a very robust, governed semantic model and ontology and all of that work. And that, you know, the skill and everything for the AI, make sure it gives, you know, goes to that context before giving an answer and not just making up, which, you know, everyone knows hallucinating.
Yeah. But that's the less sexy part of it, right? No one wants to work on that part. That's the problem. So data governance should have always been at every company and every organization. But now people want to hop over that step and say, I just want AI to fix all my problems.
It gives you more problems. You just don't realize it's giving you those problems at the time.
It's like as though there's certain teams, I would say, have gone way further than they should have with... without the governance in place, and then they're trying to kind of go backwards to try and kind of put what should be there in, and half the time they're finding that if you start right from the beginning again and go from step one again, it's much easier, it's more cost effective as well, and I think the results are a lot better. It's quite tricky when you've put things into production, though.
Yeah.
I think that's what everyone's suffering with at the moment, is how do you without kind of taking the production offline, how do you get to a stage from here to here with the right kind of governance in place? I think, like I was saying about the AI governance, I think... Some of the things that we didn't anticipate are starting to come up now as well, when models are evaluating other models, or they're taking certain context and they're thinking that this is what it means. Because don't forget, what we're trying to do is mimic human behavior, right? Okay. And me and you as humans, if we're working in a certain type of organization and we've been there for a while, we understand certain terminologies, certain ways that people portray things within the business. Even if you put that into the semantic layer, they can still get it wrong. And the only way that they can move forward from that is to learn from it. But if they've made several mistakes along the way, the trust is eroded. Again, we go back to trust.
They're learning the wrong output, and their understanding gets worse with every iteration.
Yes, correct.
Which is why the human in the loop is so important. Just a small example, when I was doing my course, my master's course, and we were getting into ethics of AI, we did this case study on radiologists and the future of radiology. and how AI can potentially help. I mean, it's also a lot of it's just machine learning algorithms, and sometimes it's a little bit more of a cool term to say AI. But a lot of the data that was fed into the radiologists, the models that the radiologists were using, comes from specific user groups. So you will look at affluent socioeconomic centers where the hospitals have partnered with research centers where they can actually share the data. And there was this finding where perhaps people from the African continent or certain East Asian nations, that data is never shared with the models. And you could be making completely wrong diagnoses because those humans are just exhibiting different behaviors. And that's why it's up to the radiologist. Maybe their job just becomes a little bit more streamlined where they're checking whether the output is correct based on the knowledge that they have, but they still need to review, you know, special cases in depth. But if you let the models paint every patient with the same brush, you're going to be making the wrong diagnoses, right? It's very scary if you think about aviation, healthcare, in those terms, even financial services, right? That's where things become very detrimental to society.
Yeah, and we talk about reputational risk right there. You know, big financial organizations, one small wrong move without someone having oversight of an agent doing something can be, you know, stock prices going through the, you know, tanking.
Well, just risk models, like you know, certain risk models that people have, you know, for years they've built these risk models where it's adjusting ever so slightly based on, you know, years of experience. And they've now bolted AI onto it. And not just like as in like not in the production or anything like that. They've just trialed it, shall we say, on the side, shall we say. And when it works, it works. Mm-hmm. But when a certain individual, I'm not going to name his name, a certain individual goes on Twitter, it goes berserk. Mm. When a certain event happens, shall we say, that's not been seen before, like you said, he goes berserk. Yeah. Because he doesn't know what to do. Again, we go back, it's not human.
No, exactly.
It's not human.
I'm going to change gear slightly.
Yep.
So we're talking about AI, so we'll stay on this topic very quickly. How do you go about innovating and finding use cases? Kind of what does that process look like in your world? And, you know, for anyone out there that's listening or watching that wants to get in and start bringing in AI into their organization, kind of, have you got a framework that you go through? Is there, do you kind of find use cases? Do you find, you know, do you go to the technology first and see where you can fit it in? Love your perspective.
So actually, I'm going to repeat what I did say. So I have that three-layer framework.
Yep.
Again, for me, it's very important to get my team to stop spending time on things that are too manual or repetitive. So how can I help folks on the ground leverage AI to make their lives better? So that's just code reviews, just using Copilot itself to check code, and then the automation. So basic automation, if the data is ready. And then the third layer, which takes the longest amount of time, is to do AI on top of the data. And that's very use case specific. So the most challenging part is allowing or asking your organization to give you the time to get the data ready. This can take months of effort to get your semantic layer correct, to make sure the output is correct, cross-checking it, using different, you know, terminologies, and then setting up the APIs to make sure your agent works.
Yeah,
these things go full cycle, because I saw it in big tech in America, you know, the Salesforces of the world. Went through big layoffs bringing in AI to automate sales roles. And, you know, I've made all these layoffs, but the AI just wasn't quite ready to take on automating an entire job like that. So customers were having really bad experience with it. So then you've got the cost of tokens, plus CX is going down because you've got an agent interacting with your customers who just want to speak to someone. And, you know, it's very structured, ask a question, get a response type. So they're starting to hire back people. Mm. So, you know, we might find that AI, you know, it's going to do all your pipeline work. It's going to do your semantic modeling for you. It's going to do all your synonyms and all of this data work. It's supplementary, But I feel like the ones that start stripping back data teams will come back and realize, actually, we still need those people because they've got context, they can spot mistakes, they can work with, I can have a conversation with a business user to understand a requirement much better than an agent can.
Well, I was going to add, so the AI strategy, part of the AI strategy should be, how do you redeploy these people? How do you take their skill sets and their knowledge, and especially in their knowledge, it's probably 50-60% of, you know, what, you know, the spec, shall we say. How do you take their knowledge and redeploy them into the business? That it should be part of the strategy.
And I'm okay to go back online now, because I was going to say, I think what it allows us all to do now is become spanner employees. This is a term that I heard a few months ago, and I love it. I've seen my leaders push me into this. And when I was younger, I didn't understand why I needed to learn about data warehousing, but anything else. But I think this is the best time to do it. You have the business domain expertise. Mm-hmm. AI is helping me with a lot of automation and making my tasks easier and my team's tasks easier. Now it's time to get involved in the flywheels of product. Now it's time to get involved in decision making, get out of the world of data and get into the world of business. And now you're fully integrated into that community, but you're way more valuable because you know how the decisions are being made and you know what's feeding that output. Yeah. So it's actually a golden opportunity for us to just go beyond. And I think the differentiator is going to be domain context understanding. You see a lot of tech folks, even in data analytics and data science, who resist that so much. They want to be left alone. They want to,
I was one of them.
Probably better now though, right? In leadership, you learn the value of knowing what it is that we're solving for. Again, what decision is this data point going to drive? Mm-hmm. And the better you are at bridging that gap, the more successful all of us will be.
Yeah.
I love data teams and data leaders that can articulate that back to their teams about the impact that they've done. I know I used to work with a delivery company in the UK, so they'd do a stand-up and present dashboards and use cases, and then, but they would have business leaders come in and say, you know, that piece of work that you did for me helped us do X, Y, and Z. You know, and you feel really empowered as a data analyst to say, you know what, I've got executives using my dashboard to actually drive, you know, bottom line revenue or reduce, you know, costs and improve efficiencies or whatever that might be.
And you know what that's going to drive? Better dashboard building, because you're going to be in the rooms where people are talking about it, and they'll say, I wish we had this. So I also believe in autonomy, like get those people, the ICs, into the meeting. Bring them in, let them hear what's being discussed. A, they'll have the business understanding, and B, there is that sense of empowerment to say, my work is not going into the void. Yeah. I'm not just spending 8 hours a day doing nothing. It matters.
How has your role changed over the last 5 years, let's say?
I think Kareem was...
You can, if you don't want to say names...
Kareem has been probably the single most challenging but rewarding places I've worked at. And I always am very thankful for my time there, because I've learned so much. Before I joined, everyone would tell me, or my first month there, they're like, oh, 6 months at Kareem is like 2 years anywhere else. And you're like, sure, everyone says that about a company. But I can understand, after having been there for 3.5 years, why they became the first tech unicorn in the region. There's a constant drive to innovate, push yourself, be better. And if I didn't work at Kareem, I would not be who I am now. So my leadership skills, my ability to deal with stakeholders, to make difficult decisions, it's all thanks to a lot of the companies I've worked at, but mostly at Kareem. So I'm very grateful for my time there. I'm also grateful to come back into more of a legacy kind of company like OSN. Because you get to learn about how to adapt to different ways of working, learning a lot about different types of analytics, like commercial analytics, and what drives decision-making in a company that has to do with media and streaming. But I think I will forever be grateful to Kareem for putting me through.
Bless you, Kareem.
The ringer.
It's an amazing story, though. Kareem have got an amazing story. And like you said, the first unicorn in this region. And their product, you can't fault their product. Most recently, I had the privilege of working with the guys that are creating the, you know, there's the taxi side. Now they're doing the air taxi side. So, you know, like, it's phenomenal. Like Sharma said, the continuous need to innovate is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And once you get that bug, it's like you can't let it go, you know, and you want to continue and continue and continue.
And the people that I work with at Careem, I'm still in touch with a lot of them. So I think that's something else that you really value once you've left a company, like a tech hub or a tech org. They force you to be better. Again, my mentor, Form Careem, had told me, he came from Meta in the US, and he said, you should walk into a company and feel like you don't know what you're doing. And that's the best place to thrive as an individual. And that's what Careem did to me. I thought I'd be great. I was a hotshot at my previous job. And you come back and you're like a fish out of water.
Whoa, I've got a lot to learn.
And you work with the best people in the region. I can truly believe that. The engineering teams are great. The product teams are great. So I think stretch me beyond belief. And I can't wait to get back into a similar kind of environment where, you know, innovation is seen as something that we should constantly be striving for.
Don't mention names if you don't want to, but where have you either failed or something's been such a challenge that you've learned from, and what could you take away and give back to our audience?
I think it would also be at Careem. and it's the type of environment that forces you to flourish and fail at the same time.
A great place to live.
Exactly, because the failure brings with it immediate ways to bounce back and become resilient. So when I joined, I was a manager of none. I did not know what I was doing. I had no idea what the data meant. I was expecting to be a manager. I had to come into IC, into a team that was very wary of me. So I had to lean into my soft skills, which is building trust while learning the data, which I didn't know where to find it. And getting the business context. And it was very hard to manage multiple products at the same time as a single person. And that's where I think I felt like I was dropping the ball. Maybe not failing, because I did stay. But I felt like I didn't know what I was doing in those first 6 months. But the support system is there, you know. Again, because everyone is innovating, and they kept telling me, they're like, you'll be fine. It's the first few months is always hard at Careem. Having that community around you that has the same values, it really helped me. And so with the failure, I thrived. Very, very challenging 3.5 years, but probably the most rewarding.
Brilliant.
There was some belief in you.
Little bit.
Going in as someone new to a new business, you said that there's lots of challenges, but one of the things is learning the data.
Yeah.
How did you go about it? And would you do the same again? Or were there kind of different ways to go in and learn the business and the data?
Do you know what? I'm going to structure it slightly differently. How do you go about it when you go from one, like as in one area of business to another? So like, you know, from, I don't know, media to construction.
Did you steal my question? And
yes, I did. Yeah. Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, noted, everyone. Noted.
So I actually think, I'm not just saying this, business context is so important. So when I started at Careem, my family can attest to this, I immediately stopped ordering food from any other, this is before I started, I just had the offer. I was like, okay, we're going to use Careem for everything.
Is this loyalty or?
No, I need to know the product.
Okay.
I need to get into the app. I need to see the customer journeys and flows. I started using it for food delivery, for groceries. I joined and I was on the pay team. So I started using it for financial transactions, because I feel like if you don't know the product, you have no idea what the customer journey is and the customer flow is. And Careem is very focused on customers. When I joined OSN, the first thing I did was I went to them and I said, I need the box. I need to see what our customers see, because I can't just report on KPIs if I don't know what they're driving. So business context, and I will continue to go around the same point as, what decision am I trying to drive? Because if I'm not helping the business in any way, I'm not useful for the company. So how do I learn about the business when I keep switching is I get into the business. I go use the product and I talk to all the business owners and I say, what's important to you? What are your targets? What are your KPIs? What are you coming up with? And how do you want me to help you? What are you blocked on? What are you blind on? And let me then solve those problems for you.
I think technology companies do a very good job of, you know, getting their employees to use the product. Same at Tableau. When I was at Tableau, it doesn't matter who you were at Tableau, everyone used Tableau. You know, you could sit in a meeting and get it up and know, you would know how to show someone what Tableau and dashboarding was. Other organizations, the same. I worked at Salesforce. You know, everyone uses Salesforce for everything. Slack, this, that. You go outside of those other industries and, you know, you might work in financial services, but bank with a completely different bank and not actually know what that customer experience is like. But I think it's super important when you work in a product or data role to understand it. Because like you say, you're capturing user journeys, you know, the KPIs, the metrics, financial, whatever that might be of the business. So having that deeper understanding and translating it is really, really important.
But even if you worked for a financial organization that you don't bank with, go open a bank account with them. You'd probably have to anyway as an employee, right? That's what I mean. Like it's very easy to get your hands on the product that your company is investing in. When I was at the airport in aviation, I worked in air traffic control. So I went and sat at the tower multiple times. I went and just explored the airport as a customer journey, even though that wasn't my remit. I just like getting close to business, and I encourage everyone in my team, especially the junior folk. I'm not sure if you've noticed it. You're in data engineering, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're very technically capable. Oh, they're fast. You see them and you're like, I could never do what you're doing as quickly as you're doing it, but they never have the full understanding of the business.
Correct.
And that's what changes, even in data engineering, especially in data engineering, that's what builds your base foundations better. So I force it on them. You have to learn the product, even if it's construction. Go to the sites, see the end products, see the process. There's always a way to get involved.
Yeah, so I was going to say, we see the data foundation, like as in the foundation is the data, yeah, right? And if you get the foundations right, you know, the walls and the windows will go in absolutely fine and they'll be straight, yeah? Again, the other foundation within a business is the product. You know, what are you selling? You know, what are you doing? I think I'll go into a little bit of a story. I think I've told this story to you before. So when I joined a training company, what they did is every month they have this competition. Everyone that starts new, and I think from what I remember, there was 9 of us. They give them a trading account with X amounts. Ours was, I think it was $10,000 or something like that. And they say, come up with a strategy, right? Trade and try and make some money, right? I think out of all nine of us, I think it was 4 of us that actually made some money. The rest of them just lost the whole pot, shall we say. But it taught me a lot about trading. I've worked in financial services before. I actually worked for a commodity trader probably about 15 years ago, roughly, give or take. But I never, ever got into the product there. I always built the spec there. But those times were very different. I think those times you could just build a spec and, you know, and push it out and it was enough. And then you got a reiteration and then you go with the flow, shall we say. And I was part of a much bigger team, shall we say. There's, I think, 10 engineers altogether. At that time, I was an engineer. But I felt as though that introduction, and it wasn't just me as a senior manager, it was, you know, junior guys that are going to work on the sales floor, shall we say. And it was so important for us to understand what the retail client on the other side is doing, how their journey begins, the challenges they come across, what they need to find out, what they need to research, how they play with the product as well. Because I played with it for a long period of time before I even placed the trade. I'm just cautious, overly cautious. Whereas other guys, they just went, oh yeah, that news is saying this to me. And honestly, when we joined the Teams calls every morning to see, you know, how each of us have got on during the day, because basically we had a whole week to do just trading and not our day job, shall we say. Yeah?
What's I doing again? Oh, he's working, trading. He's losing all our money in our corporate
account.
It's
actually the part of the onboarding process for the company.
That's great.
And, you know, I thought, like, my takeaway from that was when I started to look at the data sources, shall we say, I knew exactly what I was looking at from the front end to the back end.
Yep.
And it's like you said, for the data engineering teams, for the data science teams even. Because sometimes I've come across scenarios where the use case is we want to hyper-parameterize something, yeah? And this data scientist is going to look at this, this, that, and the other. They've not shown him what they're actually trying to achieve. The way I see it, and like you said as well, Shoma, that understanding the product is halfway to building, the perfect solution, should we say. Without understanding the product, he's just going based on what the requirements Gavin has been presented to him.
Kind of like an AI agent.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we are coming up on time. Yep. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast. For business leaders and people in the GCC in the region, what should we be looking out for and preparing for over the next 18 to 24 months? We touched on how quickly AI is innovating, but is there anything else top of mind you think we need to prepare for?
I think we should be focusing on the Spanner employee. I think we should be looking at the younger generation who can do more with less, because a lot of their tasks will be stripped away from them. So hyper focus on one area or expertise might be detrimental to someone. I would be more interested in a candidate or someone in my team who can be a data scientist as well as a communicator and a storyteller. I need someone to do more because they're going to have more time to do it. I think AI is very important. I think we're going to start to see a lot of governance, like you said. Laws might start to get introduced, and we have to think about how we safeguard our companies and our employees from potential misuse of the agents and how that could impact our reputation, but also our financials. For me, that's very important. In the short term, I think we're going to have to do more with less, but I think, as you mentioned, we might see a little bit of a turnaround where we have the opportunity to build teams to be larger again and just work on more creative problem solving.
Final question from me. What are your top three favorite tools or platforms you like working with?
So I'm a Claude convert.
Okay. I think most people are nowadays. I used to use Chat. Now I'm purely Claude.
I switched from ChatGPT.
If you're from the techie world,
Claude. I'm more commercial, but I use Claude.
ChatGPT was like, that's just a beta product.
Yeah, Claude is kind of my daily go-to. For a lot, it's almost like the rubber duck now that I, instead of talking to my rubber duck, have you heard about the rubber duck the engineers keep? I talk to Claude and I say, just reason with me. Is my flow okay? Is my logic okay? What am I missing? Apart from AI, I still think one of my favorite BI tools will always be Tableau. And I'm not saying that because you have like
soft spot in my heart.
I think it's beauty with reporting. And for me, it's so close to my heart because a story is so important, and a beautifully presented story is going to be listened to more, heard more than an ugly one. And I think SQL. I know I said I wasn't good at it, but I think it's the bread and butter, and people don't realize how critical SQL skills are to people in my field. So yes, Python's very important, but SQL is the foundation that you can't live without for now. That might change. So on a daily basis, I use.
So these are my key takeaways from our conversation today. If you're in data, whether you're a data leader or anyone in data, go learn SQL, foundational.
Yes.
Get familiar with Claude.
Yes.
Learn to tell a story with dashboarding and be a spanner in the nicest way possible. And that means going out to the business, understanding the product, understanding the customers, talking to business unit heads, understanding process, use cases, KPIs, because then that way you're going to understand the data better.
Exactly.
And then, you know, if you're an engineer, you're going to understand, okay, how, you know, why is this data important for this dashboard or for this use case, you know, and then kind of build that story into something that's useful.
Well, I think the future of workforce is going to be spanners. Like literally everyone's going to become a spanner. As AI gets better and better, you are going to come to a stage where you can become reliant on AI. It's going to get there. Once the governance is in place, once the guardrails are in place, it will get there. So the future workforce is spanners. And if you start to think that way already, it's like I always say to everyone that asks me the question, like the engineers that are around me, especially the guys that have been in engineering, data engineering for about 10, 15 years now. They said to me, what's the next step? Like, you know, how do I feature proof myself? I said, learn. Like, as in, learn about this, learn about that. It doesn't matter what you learn about. As long as you're learning, you're constantly learning. Because it's those spanners, sometimes the specs, this is what my opinion is, in the future, the spec is going to be very, very broad. And it's like the spanner is eight, like there's eight cogs on the spanner, shall we say, yeah? As long as you feel four of those cogs, the other four you can learn.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Si, for your input, wisdom of knowledge and your experience as well to complement the conversation.
I was just going
to
say, it's been an absolute pleasure, yeah. Honestly.
Thank you
it's
guys been for
a,
having me.
It's been a really, really good conversation.
And if we listen back, I think you almost called Simon a shawarmer earlier.
I didn't say
shawarmer. Are you
hungry? It sounded very close. So I'm going to have to listen back to that. So keep your ears peeled for Simon / shawarmer earlier in the conversation.
Simon's actually, one of my cousins is named Simon, Shimer. So that's why it's easy for me to pronounce.
Is it Shima?
It's Shima, but I think in the region, the Arabs have a lot of Shima.
Yeah. Shima, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I get Shima a lot, but I am Shima.
Maybe I'm hungry, maybe I heard shawarma. If people want to get in touch with you, are you open to networking, connecting on LinkedIn? Yeah. If we share your profile
I'm
notes?
On LinkedIn. I'm always happy to have a yap and chat about the future of the data world. So for sure.
Amazing. Well, been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
We need to get the hats.
I know, we need the hats.